Magazine for Friday, October 22nd. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon, in for Shannon Young. Thanks for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, with the growing population of Latinx students in Colorado, Spanish-speaking parents are getting informed about how to help their children succeed. And can a book that explains four generations of age be age-appropriate for young readers? Find out at a book signing this week in Denver. And we will hear about a new program in Telluride to cut housing costs with modular construction. At 8:30, Connections comes your way. Host Roger Wendell will speak with Michael Lennox about the decarbonization imperative, transforming the global economy by 2050. Then at 9:30, the Morning Sound Alternative will bring you an eclectic mix of music and until noon. That's all still ahead. First, these headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
The city of Denver has reached a $1.2 million settlement in a federal lawsuit stemming from a 2018 incident where three Denver police officers excessively struck and tasered an unarmed teen. Body camera footage from the incident shows Sergeant Joseph Rodart striking the plaintiff, Melo Mayak, on the head, back, and legs with a baton six times in a 24-second span. The other officers, James Martinez and Douglas Watson, used a taser while the teen was on the ground. Prior to being struck and tasered by police, Mayak was attempting to escape from the pursuing officers and fell to the ground as he neared them. Mayak suffered a broken leg, a broken nose, and multiple lacerations from the incident, and according to his attorney, has permanent limited mobility. Mayak's lawsuit alleges Denver has cultivated an environment of law enforcement brutality and deliberate indifference to the constitutional and statutory rights of citizens and residents. A Denver jury in 2019 acquitted the criminal assault charges against Rodart. According to the Denver Post, Rodart had a long history of excessive force complaints during his 20-year career and resigned in June of 2020 before public safety officials could fire him. The two other officers received 10 days of unpaid suspension in connection with the incident. The Denver Post reports the city council still needs to approve the settlement and could vote on the matter as early as Monday. The Boulder City Clerk has until November 1st to determine if signatures to a referendum that could repeal the CU South annexation agreement are sufficient. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
At least 3,336 of the more than 6,000 submitted signatures need to be considered enough by the city clerk. The signatures were gathered by Boulder residents opposed to the CU South project and wanting to force a vote that could repeal the recently approved annexation agreement. The Daily Camera reports that the agreement was approved September 21st by the Boulder City Council. The agreement guides flood mitigation and development at the 308-acre CU South site owned by the University of Colorado Boulder. If the city clerk approves the petition, the matter will be on the ballot in the next municipal election in 2022. If the city clerk finds that the signatures submitted are insufficient, those opposed to the agreement will have 10 days to gather additional signatures. In addition, a separate measure on this November's ballot is a measure also related to the CU South project. Primarily, representatives from Plan Boulder County and Save South Boulder collected enough signatures to place a ballot measure that would allow the flood mitigation work to continue, but would require a vote ahead of approval of the agreement. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Governor Jared Polis is urging the Colorado Geographical Naming Advisory Board to consider easier-to-pronounce alternatives for the board's new recommended name of a peak in Clear Creek County. The new name proposed for Squaw Mountain is Mistahay Mountain, which pays homage to a Southern Cheyenne leader known as Owl Woman. The board unanimously recommended the new name in September. The governor dropped in on the panel's monthly meeting yesterday and indicated he had just learned he was saying the new name incorrectly. According to the Colorado Sun, the governor is worried the diacritical marks meant to guide pronunciation may deter folks from using the new name while maintaining use of the current name, which is a slur. The Colorado Sun reports at least one board member pushed back on the governor's comments. Representative Adrian Benavides noted her name is often mispronounced and said mispronunciation should not be the reason to avoid using names that honor Indigenous leaders. Polis created the 15-member panel last year with a mission to change the names of Colorado's geographic features that are offensive. Mistahay Mountain is the only new name the panel has approved so far, as it addresses a growing list of suggestions and public input. State officials have announced eligible Coloradans who have received the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson vaccines may now get booster doses at any of the 1,700-plus vaccine providers across the state or at one of the state's mobile vaccination clinics. No insurance, identification, proof of residency, or medical history is required. Per updated guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Moderna boosters are recommended for people 65 and older, residents in long-term care settings, people with underlying medical conditions, and people who are at an increased risk for COVID-19 exposure or transmission. Johnson & Johnson booster doses are recommended for anyone age 18 and older. The CDC has also authorized a mix and match approach to booster doses, allowing individuals to get a different type of vaccine other than their original series. Individuals who originally received the Moderna vaccine may get a booster approximately 6 months after their second dose in the series. Those vaccinated by Johnson & Johnson may get their booster at 2 months or more after their single dose. For more information, residents may go to the webpage covid19.colorado.gov. A new laboratory at Colorado State University is attempting to research the many claims about the potential health benefits of CBD and other non-psychoactive cannabinoids. According to the Greeley Tribune, the new Panacea Life Sciences Cannabinoid Research Center at CSU was built and equipped under a $1.5 million donation from Leslie Bortorf, CEO of Golden-based CBD company Panacea Life Sciences, Inc. The Greeley Tribune reports the lab was 2+ years in the making and had a delayed opening due to the pandemic. The lab's researchers will not only set out to study the chemical compounds of the hemp plant, but attempt to discover new applications and include the disciplines of agricultural science and psychology. Today's weather for the Upper Metro Front Range includes sunny skies with highs in the low 70s. Tonight, skies will be partly cloudy with lows in the upper 30s, low 40s. The current temperature outside the Boulder studios is 37 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Jones.
Listening to the Morning Magazine on KGNU. Teresa Garcia is Executive Director of El Paso Movement, a Boulder-based group that is hosting a summit for Latino parents this weekend. The discussion will explore how parents can raise their kids in a new culture. KGNU's Rosana Longobetter spoke with Garcia about this weekend's event.
What is the Cúspide de Padres de Familia and why was it created?
The conference, it used to be called 6 years ago, Latino Parent Summit. And if you translate summit, well, in Spanish, it has several translations. So that's why I took the word Cúspide. But it's a conference that has been really developed by the parents. We have parents volunteers helping us in organizing. They choose the topics. The parents that we ask them, they choose the topics. And also, way at the beginning, the parents design how they wanted the sessions. They say, we want a 20-minute presentation and the rest time for us to ask questions. It has been amazing.
How many people have you served during these last years?
When we were doing it in person, we had the first conference, we had like 75 people. For us, was like, yay! And then the next year, it was like 125, and then it went up to 150. For us, every time that we add few numbers, was a success. And then when the pandemic came, that was talking about total unknown territory. We didn't know what was going to happen. And I don't lie to you when I tell you that every single one of the sessions have from 80 to 85 parents. to the point that when the techno savvy guy that was helping us with the conference, he called me and he said, Tere, you have almost 100 people and that's all you have space. And I said, well, 85, and it was a
I'm speaking with Teresa Garcia from El Paso Movement. We are talking about Cúspide de Padres. It's a conference that has been going on in Spanish for the parents that have kids in the districts. Please tell me which organizations are collaborating with you guys and what are the main topics that you're bringing in this conference?
We have mental health is with us. The Latino Chamber of Commerce is with us. We have SAN, Blue Sky. We have the Colorado Statewide Parent Coalition explaining the new laws. So organizations that have always been so wonderful. They don't charge us. We don't charge anything to the parents. And these organizations come and they send somebody that speaks Spanish, that knows the community, that is a Latino or Latina, and that really knows how to communicate and how to listen, how to respond and be respectful. That's the main thing.
You as a teacher, you as a mother, and you as a community member, what are the main challenges our parents, especially those that speak Spanish, have faced due to COVID-19 pandemic?
Challenges is a faulty information, and they are having a hard time figuring out which is the faulty information. That's why I'm so glad that they asked for a COVID information at the conference. But it's not just that. It's also the fact that the health of many of our immigrant parents wasn't so good to begin with. And all of a sudden we saw a bunch of parents getting sick. Thank goodness many of them made it, but then many also suffered loss. The anguish of trying to figure out, should I get the vaccine? What if I get whatever social media came out with? We have to follow science. I was a teacher. I'm a teacher. I'll always be a teacher. And I know this much about science. But one thing I know is that they have their act together. And if they told us, okay, this vaccine works, yes. And I have the vaccine, a bunch of people have the vaccine and they are fine. So this little bit of information gives me the peace that I'm doing the best for everyone, but especially for the kids. If you don't want to vaccinate yourself, that's fine, that's your freedom. But what is going to happen is that that doesn't have the vaccine, is spreading this horrible thing to their children. So when people said, oh, that's not my problem, yes, it is your problem because you live in a community. You are part of it. You're a social animal like the rest of us. So vaccinate because they're kids and they depend on us. So there's no excuse. And this thing about, oh, God is going to take care of me. Yeah, he also gave you a brain to do the right thing. And he said, help yourself so I can help you. So do it.
Teresa Garcia, Executive Director of El Paso Movement, speaking with KGNU Community Radio, Rosanna Longo-Better.
On Wings of Wonder is a new book by Netherlands-based author Doug Cosper. It's a story of two young strangers. Case is a Colorado boy who works at his family's magical carousel, and Mira is a Rohingya girl who survived the massacre of her village in Myanmar. The title references a character on a real-life carousel in Netherlands, Colorado. Nikki Kaisers caught up with author Doug Cosper and shares this audio of him reading from his book.
Case saw Mira pull the knife partway out of its scabbard. He sensed the loathing burning in her heart. Which country are we in, Burma or Myanmar? Case asked. Stupid boy, Mira snorted. Burma, Myanmar, same cursed country. She shoved the knife hard into its sheath. And Flinders says, we're still on Thai soil, Case. And Case, oh, right. Flinders and Sebastian set about foraging for dinner. Case sat next to Mira on a fallen log overlooking Myanmar. To his surprise, she didn't stand up and walk away. Mira, do you have carousels where you live? The girl said, stupid boy, with her entire body, but remained silent. Well, we have one in Nederland, the town where I live in America. It's in the mountains, but like these, but lots higher. Have you ever seen snow? Case thought Mira might kill him with her glare if she could, so he resolved not to ask her any more questions. Anyway, a carousel is this big round thing, Case paused to convert feet to meters, about 12 meters across. It has kind of a ring-shaped wooden floor and a bunch of machinery on the inside that makes it all spin around. To his surprise, Case thought Mira seemed to be listening. But the coolest thing are the animals. Mira turned to him and raised an eyebrow. They're not real animals. They're carved out of wood and painted. All kinds of animals, pretty much life-size. There's a lion and a giraffe, a bear, a moose, a gorilla, an elephant. I know elephants, Mira said softly and turned away. An elephant and a deer and a dragon and a pony and a chicken. We used to have chickens. And a cheetah and birds and a dolphin and so many others. And they're so beautiful, Mira. You wouldn't believe your eyes. My grandpa carved all of them and painted them, too. The colors sparkle under hundreds of little lights above. And there's music. There's something called a band organ. It's a big wooden box with mechanical instruments inside. It's like hearing 100 musicians playing a song, but there's nobody in there. And when Gramps turns the carousel on and it starts to spin around to the music, the animals move up and down, so you're going around and up and down at the same time. It's magical, Mira. I know you would love to ride it. It sounds like a waste of time, Mira said. Yes, that's exactly what it is. Or would be if it weren't for the wonder. It has the power that Sebastian has spoken of. Sebastian is her wonder keeper. Oh, yes. Gramps called it his wonder machine. You should see the looks of the children's faces when they ride it. When the carousel spins, their eyes open up as wide as you can imagine. Gramps says that some of them, he can see the light of wonder flowing into their eyes. He tried to teach me to see it, and sometimes I thought I actually saw light. And you want to know the funny thing? I was pretty sure I could see it best in the eyes of kids with disabilities. They couldn't talk or walk or sometimes even eat, but they sure had a powerful sense of wonder. Is that why Flinder chose you? Because you could see this light? Case had to stop and think a moment. Well, now that you mention it, maybe it was. Silence settled over the log like a cloud. Finally, Mira spoke, not with anger, but as from another place. I knew wonder once.
There's just so many messages. These characters are out to protect wonder and use it for the forces of good. We understand that it conquers greed that lurks in the shadows. And it's really the seed of creation, a life-giving force that's to be nurtured along with the truth. And that human history is an ebb and flow of times of light and shadow. And fear and hate kill wonder, and greed and suspicion are its opponent, if you will. And so they go to great battles, of course. I wonder if you could read the bottom of 91, 92.
Yes, in this scene, Case and Mira are learning from Flinder and Sebastian, who have been protectors of wonder for no one knows how long, to explain why wonder is so important. Case says, I don't understand. I get that wonder is important and all, but why fight over it? Case, Flinder paused, what would you say if I told you that wonder is the most powerful force in the world? Mira's back straightened. At least she doesn't get this either, Case thought. I say you must be a little nuts. Wonder isn't powerful. It's just something people do when they don't have anything else to do. It doesn't do anything. Armies are powerful. So most people believe, Flinder said. But everything good in the world begins the moment a child wonders about something.
That was Doug Cosper reading from his book On Wings of Wonder. He will be signing the book tomorrow at the Second Star to the Right bookstore in Denver. You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. High housing prices mean local workers are getting priced out of communities they serve across the Mountain West. One nonprofit in southwest Colorado is trying to make small-town housing affordable by turning to factory-built homes. KOTO's Matt Hoisch has more for the latest installment in our series with Rocky Mountain Community Radio and the Solutions Journalism Network, highlighting affordable housing across the region.
Housing takes time. Kiefer Perino knows this. He's been working on one affordable housing development for local workers since before the pandemic.
It's been a couple years versus a couple months in the making.
Perino is the mayor of Norwood, Colorado. The roughly 600-person town is shaping up to be the first to get about two dozen deed-restricted workforce housing units from a new initiative launched by a local nonprofit, the Telluride Foundation. They're taking a simple but potentially powerful approach, building houses for less money.
If you work backwards from a teacher in Norwood, they're making $41,000, they can afford a $180,000 home.
That's Paul Major, president and CEO of the foundation.
Can we actually deliver a $180,000 three-bedroom, two-bath, two-car garage home?
To get the cost down, Major breaks it into three buckets: land, financing, and construction. When it comes to land, the foundation is trying to get it for free. San Miguel County has donated the parcel of land in Norwood. For financing, a mix of public and private donors have put forth low-cost capital. Finally, there's construction.
The first thing that comes onto a on-site construction project is the dumpster, because 30% of all materials that come onto a construction site are waste. They turn out to be waste.
To solve that problem, the foundation has turned to off-site construction. Homes are pre-built in a factory and essentially installed onto the site. David Bruce manages the housing initiative for the foundation. He says that off-site building can reduce construction costs per square foot by about 75%. And he adds, there's nothing new about the approach.
People have been talking about that since the 60s. And one of the reasons it hasn't sort of taken on this effect and revolutionized the construction industry the way, you know, Ford assembly line has is because, you know, there's a huge advantage just to you and me going to a building site, bringing some lumber with us, and there's a flexibility to build on site that is actually hard to calibrate and line up once you prefabricate everything.
For an existing example, he suggests I look into another similar large-scale development called The Farm in Buena Vista, Colorado. So, I do.
Micah Salazar, I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Fading West Development.
Fading West Development is the developer behind The Farm. So far, Salazar says, they've built 86 houses using off-site construction, and all of them have sold for between roughly $200,000 and $500,000. And he notes, even though they're not deed restricted, a little more than 80% of the people living in them are part of the local workforce.
We really can't build them fast enough at this point.
The best way that I can put it is the impact has just been huge.
Duff Lacey is the mayor of Buena Vista. He says he hasn't heard anything negative from his constituents about The Farm, but he notes the factory-built units are still a couple hundred thousand dollars. So he thinks they're not a cure for all the region's housing challenges, but they fill a void.
There's still a gap, but this is definitely taking care of a sector that is looking for housing.
Of course, there's no guarantee the Telluride Foundation homes will sell as quickly as the Buena Vista ones, but Major is confident. A study found there's pent-up demand for over 30 affordable homes in Norwood, more than the foundation plans to help build. They're also working on similar projects in nearby Nucla, Ridgeway, and Ouray. All in all, the projects could result in over 100 new deed-restricted homes for local workforces. And, if all goes well, more could follow.
We see this as an opportunity to potentially see this work in a pilot format and potentially scale this in other parts of rural Colorado that need new housing construction.
Rick Garcia is the executive director of the Colorado Department of Local Affairs. He says once they see one or two of the projects completed and homeowners moving in, the state is prepared to help other communities take a similar approach. The Telluride Foundation hopes to break ground in Norwood next year and have folks moving in by fall 2022. For KOTO and the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Coalition, I'm Matt Hoisch.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Alexis Kenyon, in for Shannon Young. Special thanks today to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, Rosanna Longo-Better, Nikki Kaiser, and Shannon Young. Stay tuned for Connections with Roger Wendell just after this news update from the BBC.